Change doesn't wait. Sometimes it storms in, sometimes it creeps quietly, unfolding in ways we notice later. It stirs in boardrooms, classrooms, streets, and communities, wherever people act with purpose. What moves you? A vision? A challenge? A belief in business as a force for good? And what holds you back? External factors or limiting beliefs? I'm Gary Watts, and this is Moved, the podcast of 289 people inspiring change. I'll be speaking with people exploring what first moved them, what they've achieved, and the challenges they've had to overcome, both outside and within. Each episode is about human performance, leadership, sustainability, doing the work that matters, and the moments that change everything. This is Moved. The next one of my 289 guests is someone who's made a career out of asking big questions and then getting people to laugh at the answers. Stuart Goldsmith is a stand-up comedian, the host of the legendary Comedians Comedian podcast, and someone who's been shaping how we think about comedy, creativity, and even climate. He started on stage, honing his craft, launched a podcast, not just about comedy, but about resilience and handling challenges. And over the years, he's become a voice not just to make people laugh, but to make them think. He's deeply curious about human behaviour, helping others, storytelling, and taking action on climate issues. And somehow, he does it all while staying genuinely funny, thoughtful, and completely human. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Very good. So when I started this podcast, I never imagined that I'd be speaking to a comedian, certainly so early into the episodes. The idea that I was going to speak to 289 people related to SDGs or people doing good work. And at that point, I didn't think there'll be a comedian on the podcast. But here we are, Stuart Goldsmith. We met a few weeks ago, and you're joining me now.
Yes, ironically, I occasionally think of this. It's not good enough fodder for a joke, but my initials are SDG. Hence, it's nominative determinism at its best.
Your initials are SDG?
Yeah. Middle name David, the least interesting of all the middle names.
Very good.
So I'm a sustainable development goldsmith.
Sustainable development goldsmith.
Unless the first time I said that out loud, I expected to hate it. Actually, it quite tickled me.
Yeah, very good. So where I wanted to start was... you're a climate comedian. I know you do other things, but the first question would be how you got into climate comedy.
Long story short, I've always been a performer of some sort. I was a street performer at Covent Garden for 10 years. Then for the last 20 years, I've been a stand-up. And there's some other stuff to do with some of the work I do for corporates. I basically have hosted my own podcast for the last nearly 14 years called The Comedian's Comedian. Loads of listeners to that, people from all walks of life, would get in touch and say, this is really useful for my job as a hostage negotiator or parfumier or dentist lecturer or all sorts. And eventually enough of them were kind of business minded and said, hey, you should come and talk to us. Come and do a session. So I started doing a session on what comedians can teach people about resilience, because that's the nature of my podcast, is all about how do you cope. So then I came to a point where, having drunk very, very deeply from the well of stand-up comedy, you know, interviewing people, just gigging all the time, I just was a bit, I don't want to say bored, but I have ADHD and that's all about novelty. And I think a lot of what drew me to it was novelty. And I was a bit frustrated. I was a bit like, what next? Another 20 years? At the same time, I was feeling an enormous amount of climate dread. And really, the two problems kind of, I won't say solved, but they kind of provided, they had an impact on each other, basically. I started talking on stage about the climate crisis. It was incredibly difficult to get people on board with that, very hard to make people laugh about it. That then provided a more exciting challenge for stand-up that reinvigorated my excitement about stand-up, and B, a brilliant way to process my own climate dread on stage. So that moment was about 4 years ago. And after that, I've barely looked back. There was a period about 3 years ago when I realized if I go and do a gig and have a lovely gig, but I haven't said anything about the climate, it feels like a bit of a waste of, not, I won't say waste of time, a wasted opportunity. Yeah. So I've just become really, really hooked on it.
Wow. Fabulous. So it started around 4 years ago, and there's so many things in what you just said, but some of it was around the podcast, and I've actually been listening to the Comedian's Comedian podcast. You hit 500 episodes recently, didn't you?
I'm about to. The episodes are all in the can. I've recorded 500. We'll release episode number 500 in so early January. Yeah.
In early January. Yeah, so that was where you started then with the podcast.
Yes, that's what. Well, I've been a comic for about 7 years, and the podcast came along because I say it came along. This was at a time when very few people were podcasting. I mean, Adam and Joe, there was the Ricky Gervais podcast. I'd heard one or two others, mostly like American history podcasts and stuff. And I really had just, I was a bit of an eternal student for a long time. I was like, I went to circus school, then I did a sort of devised theatre degree, worked for a couple of years as an actor. Then I did, before that, I did an actor training course for a year in Cardiff. And then I was just kind of constantly learning to do stuff, ended up a few years later becoming a full-time stand-up comedian and just felt, this is insane. This is my job and it's my livelihood. And I've done no training in it. And there are, you can do a lot of training these days, but I didn't know about a lot of it at the time. So I thought, much better. I think what I thought was, I'll try and get a comedian who I consider brilliant. And I'll say, right, can me and 19 other new comics like me get together? We'll all put 20 quid in and you give us a lecture on how to be brilliant. And they went, absolutely not. No way. But I'll buy, you can buy me a coffee and chat to me. And I went, oh, yeah, that's fine too. Had a lovely conversation with this comic. And then came away from it realizing I'd already forgotten half of it and thought I should have recorded that. And then lo and behold, the next time I did it, I recorded it. And here we are, 25 million downloads later.
Wow. And I had thought I'd seen episode 500 actually on last.
Well, it may be because it's been going for so long, the actual numbers of like, it might not be the 500th interview. It might be something like this interview was split into two parts 3 years ago. And so it's nudged the numbers forward. But
That's
in
it.
terms of number of official guests, I'm on something like 495 is being recorded next Tuesday.
Impressive stuff. And then you mentioned resilience. So some of the theme is actually around resilience, and then on to climate dread. So just digging into what you focus on around resilience and where that came from.
Well, in terms of the podcast, resilience is quite a highfalutin term for it, really. It's just about coping. It's just about coping. How do you cope? This is what I started off asking my guests, how do you write your jokes? That was my kind of obsession. And all of them said the same thing. All of them said, oh, I don't really have a system. And then I'd probe a little bit more and they'd go, well, obviously I do this, 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 and this, and then that. And it was always totally different for everyone. It's fascinating. But after I'd done sort of 30 or 40 of them, like the same tropes started to repeat themselves, and I realized I was much more interested in how th whether they got what they wanted from comedy. What does it cost them? How do they keep going? How do they pick themselves back up after a bad gig? Those kind of things, much more in keeping with, but I'm fascinated about jo writing jokes, but I've been trying to cope since I was a kid, so I talked to a lot of people about their what I realize now in hindsight, they're all sort of takeaway insights about strategy for dealing with things going wrong. So now when I talk to businesses, and I've got a session coming up for the lawn care industry in ground care, they call it ground care. So I do all these sort of like corporate events and what have you. And what I go in with there is these are the th this is how Jimmy Carr copes with having a panic attack on stage in front of 20,000 people. Because I asked him about it and he told me this is how Sarah Millican copes with seeing someone in the audience not smiling, or how Bill Burr or Kathy Griffin, or you know what I mean, just like comedian after comedian, how they cope with writing jokes, feeling vulnerable. That's a sort of an element of the session really is about how comedians like anyone, like business leaders, a lot of the time are simultaneously the most powerful person in the room and the most vulnerable. So a lot of it is about how the resilience of comedians is something learnable. Easy to look at a comic on stage in front of an arena of people and go, wow, they must have been born with it. Well, surprise, surprise, no, we weren't. All of us just put ourselves into danger over and over again, more or less intentionally, depending on the person. And we learnt slower or faster, depending on the person, how to overcome those nerves. how to feel okay, how to be okay in yourself when you're on stage and you've just done a callback to a bit you now realize that you forgot to set up because they're all just looking at you blankly. How you cope with those events when you've died on your ass in front of your hero and 3 months later you're lying in bed remembering it. How you cope with kind of rumination. How you deal with hecklers, whether those are people shouting stuff out at you at gigs or people in business environments mansplaining to you or you know, taking the credit for your work or putting their hands up in a meeting and say, it's not a question, it's actually more of a comment. Do you know what I mean? That kind of thing. How do you mediate that? How do you manage it? And ultimately, how do you separate your self-worth from your work? Which is, I think, the quest that an awful lot of us are on. How can you make a mistake? We know that if you make a mistake, the best way to fix it, it begins with feeling okay about it. But how do you achieve that in real terms when it's not just, do you know what I mean? I love addressing the kind of internal mental landscape of my audiences for those sessions and the audience for the podcast, because it is so easy to see a picture on the wall with a dolphin on it all about motivation. You know, sure, you can come up with a thing and go, oh, that's my thing. I'm going to think that every time. But how do you actually action it in your life and change?
Yeah, that's really important stuff. You mentioned a few things, but one of the questions you said you sometimes ask is like, do you get what you want or need from comedy and how you manage those things? Do you get, I guess, what you want from comedy and how do you manage those things?
Yes, I do. I really do. It's not what I expected or anticipated at all, but I have definitely got things from it and I've discovered it. It's helped me discover who I am. And I think that's part of why I went into it. Can't speak for everybody. But part of it is like, how will I cope with this? There's an expression in Brazilian clowning, in boca de lupa. It means the mouth of the wolf. And that's the stage, right? The audience are looking at you and you step out there into the mouth of the wolf. And any second it could snap shut, you know?
Yeah.
And so I've been throwing myself into the mouth of the wolf daily for decades now. And that has taught me something about myself. I mean, I thought I wanted to be famous. I've actually realized I really want to be special, and that's much more easily achieved. You know, I wanted community. And so I have gone some way to creating community through the podcast, through my work, through my other work. And I've learned that I really love helping. Like this kind of sort of dovetails with the climate work, because the easiest joke to tell about the climate crisis is we're all screwed. Ha ha ha. Do you know what I mean? But I don't want to tell that joke. I want to do something helpful. I'm sort of a fixer. Do you know what I mean? If I see an accident happen nearby, or if we get stuck in a lift, some people will go, we'll ring the number and wait, and I'll get us out of the lift. That's just my nature. We may fall to our deaths, but we haven't yet. So I've learned that about myself, and those things have come together in a very, an incredibly satisfying way, whereby I do feel. And not all the time, but I do feel like my self-worth, my self-worth and my work are two different things. And I love having an impact. I absolutely love it. Lasts longer than a round of applause. I've had some lovely gigs and I wouldn't give any of them up. They're wonderful. And continue to have really just big beefy laughs. You know, there's no feeling in the world like it when you've thought of a new bit and you say it that night and the audience woofs and you go, yes. Or even if it's brand new and there's just enough laughter that you think that will work. I can make that work.
Yeah.
There's no feeling in the world like that. But something like another feeling, another broader, deeper kind of feeling is, oh, I think I helped that person thinking about this thing differently because of a suggestion I made or a parallel I drew or what have you. And that helps. And that's a bit, I don't know. I don't want to look down on comedy. I love comedy to bits, but there is something pretty meaningful about helping.
Yeah. I never really heard it described like that, but that makes a lot of sense now you say it. Going into the wolf, the mouth of the wolf, I'd not really heard that, but it makes a lot of sense that in some ways it's quite a high risk.
It's very high risk. I mean, the thing is with comedy, I've literally had firefighters or he wasn't a fighter pilot, he was a commercial pilot, say, oh, I could never do what you do. That's terrifying. You know, you mental. Do you know what I mean? Like people who literally soldiers, you know, people who put themselves in real harm's way. But the reason that they wouldn't attempt comedy, and a lot of them would and could if they had the right tools. But what you're putting on the line is not your physical safety. What you're putting on the line is your dignity. And that is a whole different kettle of fish. Do you know what I mean? That's a whole... That's the idea of risking your dignity is extraordinary. And I, you know, I'm no expert in that. I do it in, I've learned tools to do it in a manageable way. I think some of the things that scare me, people who can freestyle rap. Do you know what I mean? People who can literally take suggestions from the audience and then rap brilliantly about it. I know a couple of people who work, Baba Brinkman or Chris Turner or people like there's a Banderman.
Yeah.
Who are what, like, to me, that's like, that would be me being the firefighter going, I can never do what you do, you know? So there's definitely levels of it, you know?
Yeah, amazing. I love how, you know, obviously in comedy, but how you're thinking about, you know, you're thinking about the mind and resilience and yourself, but also that, you know, you're thinking about other comedians and you're thinking about the audience. So that depth, and then the things that you mentioned, as well as obviously making people laugh, you're wanting to help, you're kind of wanting to serve, you're wanting to actually help people. That's a lovely thing to think of when you're actually on the stage.
Yes, it is lovely. It's a lovely feeling, but I don't want to kid anybody here. I have just kind of rubbed my tummy and gone, yum, 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 applause for years and years and years. Like, I feel like I've come quite late to helping. There is definitely an element through which, you know, comedy can be therapeutic for an audience. Laughing makes people feel brilliant, makes me feel brilliant. Laughing at someone else makes me feel brilliant. Hearing someone on stage say something, or off stage, hearing someone share a thing that's personal to them, that makes them vulnerable to share, and you get it and go, oh God, I do that as well. I thought it was any person in the world. That has a definite warm and positive therapeutic value. But mostly I just wanted to have adventures, you know, and I did that. To be fair to myself as well, I don't think I was particularly selfish. I'm not someone who's been working in charity for 30 years, you know what I mean, making a real concrete difference. It's just that the comedy that most delights me to do nowadays is something that is a bit more outward facing rather than inward facing. Comedy can be very isolating, and your job is basically to write down all your problems, ruminate in them, and then try and make them funny. And I tend towards that sort of introspection anyway. So I am much happier these days now that my wife's got this analogy about where you point the torch. You know, a lot of comedians just point the torch at themselves the whole time. And if you point the torch, as I have, and if you point the torch outwards, oh, there's so much other stuff there you can see. I'm imagining I'm in a cave. Do you know what I mean? But like, there's all of this wonderful glittering stuff if you just looked outwards. And I think me for certain, and some comics I'm sure, have a tendency for just like, what do I think? How am I? What do I feel? And it is nice to take that and take the... That's part of why the resilience thing is so fun to do and so kind of fertile. And the podcast is why they're so fertile for insight, is because I don't subscribe to the idea that, you know, comedians are all secretly depressed. We're just people. Everyone's secretly depressed. It's just that comedians have a license. We're encouraged to talk about it. Yeah. I think it's more accurate to say that comedians are particularly articulate.
Yeah.
So, definitely. You know, in a particular way, writers are also, you know, authors are wonderfully articulate speakers of all sorts. But there is something really, to me, endlessly fascinating about hearing a comedy mind apply itself to something special that we haven't thought about before, that's been hidden there in front of our noses the whole time.
Yeah.
And articulate it.
Yeah, there's a lot of depth to it. Yeah, I love that. So moving on from that to climate dread, does that sound such a serious and like horrible thing? You think you hear a lot, you know, children having that and lots of us having that. But tell me about that for you.
It's an interesting one. I was talking to my director about this yesterday because I want to be vulnerable on stage and I want to be honest on stage. And doing stand-up about the climate sometimes bumps up against, like, these, there are two contradictory forces. There's me wanting to say how I actually feel, and there's some of the things I've found out, the principles I've been told or unearthed myself about useful, positive climate communication. And sometimes those things are at loggerheads. Sometimes I know that I want to say, listen, there's a tremendous amount to be hopeful. You know, we have an obligation to hope. There's people on their knees at the minute. There's people fighting the climate crisis right now. You know, we in this part of the world that will be hit least and last during our lifetimes, at least by the climate crisis, you know, we have an obligation to hope. We should feel hopeful. I don't want to go out on stage and say, ha ha, we're all screwed. Sometimes I feel like, oh God, we're all screwed. And the bit of me that wants to be honest wants to kind of howl. You know, there are elements of the climate. If I think of the world that my children and their children will inherit. If I think of, what is it, the latest, I'm terrible with numbers. I prefer to think in sort of shapes and stories.
Yeah.
But I'm sure I read recently, we're now looking at 50-50 whether the AMOC collapses. And you know, Northern Europe is plunged into a much, much cooler temperature, much colder winters. If I just think about that, I mean, that's not even, you know, forest fires and global food crises and excess deaths from all sorts of reasons, you know, more frequent supposed freak weather events. That's not even that. It's just, if I just imagine that we've kind of screwed things so much that my children's children are going to live in just a different climate.
Yeah.
That just, I feel so responsible for that. I'm no more responsible than the next person in the top richest 10% of the country, you know, percent of the world, I mean. But we're implicated. And yeah. I think that there is some really, really scary facts out there. Now, I swing wildly between hope and despair, and that's something I do try to talk about on stage. I think giving yourself permission to swing wildly between hope and despair is better for your mental health than feeling bad about it. But sometimes I feel like money's decided it's real. Capital has decided the climate crisis is real. People want customers, and they're always going to want customers. There is, it's trending. You know what sort of long-term sustainability people say, or even what's the Martin Luther King, you know, the arc is towards justice. You know, maybe the arc is towards solving the climate crisis. So I think, hey, we can do this. And then I think, is there time? There isn't enough time. You know, so much of the climate emergency is a political problem.
Yeah.
So much of it is a political problem. We've got so much technology that we need. How do people get elected into office on a platform of the severity and ferocity and speed of the changes we need to make? How will that ever happen? How will we ever overcome the deeply invested lobbying of vested interests? How on earth will we do that? So I swing between those two things, and I will say that I feel I do feel less dread these days. I'm still scared.
Yeah.
Feel less dread. I think the dread I felt before, I felt kind of powerless as well as scared. And now I feel powerful and scared. And that's, you know what I mean? It's not the best outcome, but it's definitely different. It's definitely different. I feel more powerful. And the first show I did about the climate was called Spoilers. I'm in the middle of developing the second one. But in Spoilers, which I did in Edinburgh in 2023, I'll be out there somewhere. That show, kind of the arc of that show, the narrative arc of that show, was basically, the conclusion was, don't be scared to find out more about it. Because I do have friends, and I would never condemn anyone for this. I know that I've had conversations recently with people who said, well, you know, about 5 years ago, I just thought, this is so scary, I don't want to think about it. So I just don't think about it. And almost like the message of that first show was, well, I understand, but don't do that. Think about it, learn about it, find out about it, grapple with it. Because I think that's what I want to, that's what I do. I grapple with it constantly in life, and I grapple with it on stage, and I encourage other people to grapple with it.
Yeah. What was the shift that you went through that made you feel more powerful? What happened?
Well, I mean, one of the things, but if you know the work of Professor Catherine Hayhoe, one of the things that she says, brilliant climate scientist and communicator, she says we have to talk about it. And that's all I do now. So I talk about it all the time. So I feel like, well, if the most important thing we can do is that, I am doing that all the time. I feel like I have more agency. Chris DeMayer from the UCL Climate Outreach, he says, if you, I'm paraphrasing here, I hope I'm getting him right. He says that if you scare people, it doesn't lead them to action.
No.
Unless, because they have no agency. If you say to someone, the roof's on fire, they get scared, but you need to say the roof's on fire and the exit's over there. And then they take action because they're scared.
Yeah.
Because they have a route, they have a plan. And I feel like I have much more agency now because I've sort of turned learning about and talking about and performing about the climate into most of my working life.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a few.
For me, a big challenge now is to get better at talking about it socially, because when I talk about it on stage, I've planned it and I've rehearsed and I may improvise, but I know what I'm saying and it's a monologue. When I talk about it socially, I'm less ready. I'm less able with the questions. And, you know, and I tend to do this. I don't know if you've done this as a climate aware person. I do sometimes have a habit, particularly if I've had a pint or two, of dealing with my fear by being a bit glib about it. So, you know, dropping a scary fact on someone that doesn't know it yet and saying something which then the next morning you're like, well, who did that help? I just scared them. And I really, if I'm honest, if I x-ray my motivations, I was showing off that I knew more to make myself feel less scared.
Yeah.
You know, so I need to watch out for doing that. I would like to get better. I'm trying now to ask more questions. The thing that Professor Hayhoe says is, in terms of, she's got some very good examples on meeting people where you're at, where they're at. So she says if she goes to a, if she's going to go to a go and give a talk in a state that has a particular, what is it? Georgia does peaches, for example. This is, I'm making up, this isn't her example. But if she's going to go and give a talk in Georgia to some farmers, she will find out some very specific climate impacts about peaches that are already happening. And so she doesn't go in and say, climate emergency, big deal, huge problem, what are we going to do? She goes in and says, how's everyone's peaches doing? You noticed, I read this thing that said the peaches were a bit less, you know, a bit smaller or softer or more, or how was the harvest? It's been quite bad recently. And she'll talk to people in a language that they understand. So I suppose in as much as I try to absorb that and take it into my own work, I try to talk to audiences about our collective guilt, our collective fear, and our collective hypocrisy. And I nail myself first. I walk in, I'm the scaredest, I'm the biggest hypocrite, I've got the most guilt.
Yeah.
And I unload it all for them, and I sort of give them permission to think about and talk about theirs. Because I think that's a real detractor. That's what's the word? It's like an accelerant for, oh, I can't think about it, is feeling guilty and private and toxic and, oh God, I threw away a thing and I shouldn't do it. I'll just keep my mouth shut.
Yeah. Yeah. So that first kind of like empowerment or feeling powerful, you know, it's probably like many things. If you keep a lid on things, if you don't talk about it, it's when you actually bring it out into the open, at least for yourself and with others, then you've got agency and you're doing something about it. But also, one of the things you touched on is that people don't like to be scared. And, you know, if you tell people that how bad everything is, they are pretty much become almost like just inoculated from it. They feel like they can't do anything, and then it's gone and gone. But you're changing how you're doing it, certainly on the stage. I know you mentioned socially there's like different challenges there, but on the stage you're actually changing how this whole topic is how do the audiences initially react to this stuff?
Initially, not great.
Not great.
I mean, I the biggest fear I had was that I felt like I had to be sufficiently educated before I even started talking about it, so that when someone stood up and went, rah, 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 I'm a climate denier and this is bullshit, I could reply and say, well, actually, fact, 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 fact. That has almost never happened. And I've also realized it's not my job to convert deniers. It's a waste of time. There's so few of them. You know, what's the numbers? 89% of us want more action on the climate. You know, like we think there's millions of deniers. Well, there are millions. If it's 10%, there are millions. But we think there's this huge force in climate denial. I think it's massively over represented by the vagaries of social media. You know, robots and bots online and what have you. Robots. Is that a million years old? But they've got all these robots on the internet, Gary. So that didn't happen. So I was scared of that happening. What would happen is that I would fail to be funny enough, because you've got to be so funny when the stuff has got to be so robust. If you're going to bring up something horrible and then, or something frightening or something complicated, a lot of the jokes, you've got to do a bit of groundwork. I've got a joke about how we've not communicated 1.5 degrees very well because people don't really understand that it's a global average temperature that's subject to uneven distribution. I've got a joke at the end of that. I've got to explain it first. You know. So I'm better at that now. I feel a lot more kind of agency for doing that. But so sometimes it would be too complex or just, you know, it's a Friday night and I've got to get them into it the right way. One of the biggest challenges, I've got three or four different ways now of starting, whereby I'm basically saying I need to put my own hypocrisy up front so they know I'm not going to judge them.
Yeah.
And they know that I'm not looking down on them or presenting myself as a paragon. And I've also got to make it clear that I'm not just talking to the converts in the room. I'm not just here for the hippies and the nice old people in North Face. So I've got to sort of package up all of this information in my manner and in the first couple of things I say so that they don't all sit back and go, oh, not for me. But I've also got to, I've got to be complex, but trip lightly through the complexity. I've got to be silly and daft because that's the sort of comic I am. I'm not really I'm not Simon Amstel kind of disemboweling my internal landscape, nor am I Milton Jones with a cascade of brilliant bubbling one-liners. You know, I'm quite a silly, daft observationalist. So I need to remember to apply my specific persona, or, you know, let the persona breathe through the stuff. So, yeah, I mean, the challenges are as a list as long as your arm. But that's why it's so, so addictive, because when you nail it, and an early positive experience for me, early-ish, I would say I'd been doing, when did I go? So 2023, in 2023, in February, I went to Greenbiz, which is a huge event for like 2,500 chief sustainability officers in Arizona. Yeah. And I did the show to about 150 of them. What a night. I was so nervous. I was like, these guys, no, they're going to pick holes in everything I know. And this is like, they're going to X-ray all the stuff. Oh my God. Of course, they're people. And they, first and foremost, they were just people being in an audience. They couldn't believe someone was talking about it and making good jokes about it. It was one of the warmest rooms I'd ever played with that material. And afterwards, for the rest of my life, I remember they came up to me, several of them clutched my hand and went, thank you. And that was such a kind of like an accelerant. It was like, oh, I like this. Not famous, special. That ticks all those boxes, lights up all the dopamine stuff. But also, I've been trying to do this, kind of banging my head against some indifference along the way. You know, people who are like, sure, but it's Friday night, mate, and I've got a babysitter. You really got to talk about ocean acidification. Do you mean that no one's saying that out loud, but I'm feeling it. I'm feeling that's, you know, I'm good on what I can smell the audience. What do they need? They've had too much of this. But to have that stuff, built it up in clubs so that it was funny enough to win over people in clubs, and then take it to a room full of people, that was like being in the mouth of the something small and cute. I don't know what the equivalent is. In the mouth of the goldfish all nibbling my toes. Yeah, it was really, really, really positive. And that then sustained me that first climate show got better and better and more robust. And then I took it to Edinburgh, and it was like one of the top 50 best reviewed shows that year out of God knows 1,500 or more.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you go, oh, it's September, day one, got to do it all over again. I've got to write a whole brand new show, which now I'm pleased to say I'm really, really loving, because I have a lot of the lessons I had to learn with. And this is like my 11th hour of stand-up comedy, but my second climate hour. So many of those lessons from the first encounters with audiences, lessons about how to speak to them, how not to speak to them, how to make sure that I don't get angry at their seeming indifference, how I don't predict to myself, oh, I'm doing a joke here about whatever lithium, and they're not going for it. That means they don't care. They don't care. Now I'm mad at them. You know, like internal decisions. Maybe that I just haven't explained about lithium well enough. I've learned a lot of those lessons now, so the process has been a lot faster and smoother, and still challenging, but it's a different thing.
Yeah, I think it's tremendous that you're doing it. I think we like to talk about the weather, but we don't necessarily like to talk about the climate crisis. And, you know, in some ways, you know, like you said, the percentages are smaller, but there can be different views. But people often also just, it's not necessarily the nicest topic. But the fact you're covering this topic and you're delivering it to a room full of people on Friday and Saturday nights and so on, I think it's tremendous that you're doing that. You're the second.
Well, thank you. I'm going to sit here and lap all that up. Thank you, Gary. Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, I need this. The reason I can sort of sit here and smile and go, yes, it is tremendous, is because I'm also, it's just me when I'm in, you know, traveling home alone after a time when it hasn't worked. And God, that's happened, you know, like I will sometimes in a Friday night comedy club or whatever, you know, weekend comedy club, I'll open with I'll mention the climate first to set up that we're going to do it. Then I'll do like a 7 or 8 minute routine, which is not about the climate, or it turns out to be, but it's not visibly about the climate. And it's super relatable. And for me, it's like you've been running with lead weights and you're taking them off. Because I'm like, I remember this, just being a comedian. Oh, this is so fun. And then I'll go, right, now I've got them where I want them. Now I need to bridge into, so I am going to talk about the climate, ha ha ha, but I really am. And I'm not going to, it can be jarring. We've just been having such a lovely time. Don't worry, we're going to continue having a lovely time. It's just that the subject matter is very different. You know what I mean? Like those, so there are times when that gear change has been like, we were loving it. And this bit's fine, but can't you go back to the bit we were loving? You know? So it, you know, it's, I will say it's very positive. And this is, I should say as well, for anyone, I should say, Gary, for anyone listening who's considering booking this for their sustainability department, the stuff that I do in the world of, you know, the world of work and the business world, that's all the tried and tested, this always works stuff. I'm talking about the process here of like creating new stuff live on stage on a weekend, you know, club gig somewhere. I think that I'm always learning. I'm always learning about how to smooth the transition, how to provoke them, but in the right way, sort of destabilize them, but not upset them. I've got a joke in the show about how all I want to do is just bump everyone one stage along. You know, if you're complacent, I think you should be concerned. If you're concerned, I think you should be alarmed. If you're alarmed, I think you should take some action. And the punchline to the joke, just to murder it here, is that if you're already at the stage of taking action, there is a risk I'll bump you all the way back around to complacent. Do you know what I mean? So that's a chat. I forget the original question.
That's right. I mean, you went onto it slightly as well, because the next place I wanted to go was obviously there's the stand-up part and the comedian podcast that you mentioned, but you also meet the world of business. You mentioned that the room full of chief of sustainability officers in Arizona, but another part of what you do is as a speaker going into organizations. Can you tell us a bit more about that work?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's most of my work now. I've sort of, I'll tell you the thing I most enjoy is the best way to describe it. I'm not pitching to you, Gary, but this is a thing I often say if I'm, you know, meeting a potential client. The thing that I love most of all, and this is absolutely true, is I did a show for a big one whereby I was there to kind of pep up their annual sustainability briefing. And I was watching the briefings, always watch before I go on. I was like, okay, what's going on? And everything the person said was positive. And everything he said was either a goal that was achievable with the right effort, or some great news about a new policy. It was all good gear. And I looked out at the audience, and the vast majority of his audience, young, cool, were listening as if it was a health and safety briefing. Like they were just smiling and going, yep, right. Good. Let's get this done. They didn't feel like it applied to them. They didn't seem to, from the outside, they didn't seem like it was really going in. And then I went on all prepped and ready and what have you, and could refer back to it and had a stormer of a gig. This is like on a Tuesday at 10 o'clock in the morning sort of thing. And a lovely, lovely gig, because I'm pretty adaptable, you know, as a street performer. I've done everywhere, everything, every kind of situation. I could feel them consider it all differently. And that's what I love doing. So those things, whether it's you know, I do umpteen awards ceremonies. I am Gary, an incredibly safe pair of hands, which was a knife in my heart as a younger man, but now I'm like, no, gotta accept, gotta play the hand you're dealt. But I do loads of awards ceremonies where in the old days I'd be turning up going, well, here's 15 minutes of jokes about anything, and I hope you get on with them. I hope we get on with each other. Now I'll go and do the Business Green Awards, or the Built Environment Awards, or the Green Energy Awards, and I'm like, these guys are already on board. Man, have I got some stuff you're gonna love, you know? So I do those kind of things. But the yes, I think the most satisfying ones. And another one is I do sessions for sustainability leadership. So I work for HEC Business School in Paris, or UCL. I've got something coming up for the Erb Institute at University of Michigan, where I'm gonna do, like, I'll do the show to you know, 100 of their students, and then 30 of them, sustainability leadership people, I then do a workshop that I call climate crowd work, which is sort of insights from a climate comedian about how to get difficult messages across. Do you know what I mean? How to make those, just those things we're talking about, how to make an authentic connection with the audience, how to be vulnerable, how to be honest, how to choose which bits of your real self to share with them, how to manage not to scold them or shame them, how to get people invigorated and interested. Basically, how to get people on board with your sustainability or climate message, whatever that is, without saying, come on, guys. Because
yeah.
I think that's the big problem. That's almost the problem to which I'm offering a solution is anytime you find yourself going, come on, guys, you've lost them. So how do we say the messaging without the come on, guys bit? And I think that's where comedy and those sorts of insights can really help.
Yeah. At some point, I don't know where it will be, but at some point, there's going to be a time when I bring you into some organization somewhere, because I think this sounds fantastic.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, well, I'm very, you know, I'm very passionate about it. And I can talk about it indefinitely, as you're discovering.
Yeah,
God, I do
yeah,
have nice long answers. But it's just for me, it's the combination of my three sort of fascinations, really. I love coping with stuff and helping people cope with it and talking about strategies for that. Mm-hmm. I love comedy. I consider it so pure. It is almost at the level of religious zealotry, whereby if I'm down, if things are going wrong in the world around me, if I'm feeling sad, if I just think of either a comedian's joke that I like or just a pub joke. I don't know if you know the joke about the man with the huge orange head. Let's all remember that, all of your listeners who know that joke. Isn't that a lovely joke? I'll tell you it for the bonus content. But
okay.
if I just remember something like that, I'm like, God, isn't it good that that exists in the world? Comedy,
yeah.
no downsides. It can be used by bad people to have bad effects.
Yeah.
But the thing itself is so pure. Comedy, coping with stuff, and then trying to widen that out into climate and climate communication and this huge, ghastly, scary problem that's all around us like cold water, just making, as you say, young people are kind of growing up, and I don't have the stats, but the percentage of young people who feel that they may not have a future or that they, you know, that the world is just the number of parents I speak to who are terrified and never talk about it. Applying those things to that challenge, I just find I'll do it forever. I love it.
Yeah. So just it's probably evident, but what that 10 a.m. on that Tuesday morning when you're in that room and they've just delivered something that's like a health, they all agree, but it's like a health and safety briefing. What is it that you shifted in them? Is it like an emotional connection to it, or is it something else? What was it?
I hope it was an emotional connection, and I hope it was an unusual intervention. I hope it's just a bit of a friendly slap around the chops. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just a bit of a, like, one of the challenges, I brief with clients beforehand, and one of the things that people always want to do is, that, like, the things I hear again and again, if you're a CSO or a, you know, an ESG leadership person, the things I hear are, you know, I say, okay, tell me your goals and I'll try and write jokes about them and try and get them in front of people, you know, to underline what you're doing. They've been saying the same thing for 5 years and everyone's bored of hearing it. Or no one really knows they exist because it's a huge organization, but there's a team of one sustainability person on their own with no budget, and all they've got is influence and no money.
Mm-hmm.
So I can help them with that influence. Or every time anyone in the organization gets the word sustainability in the subject line of an email, they just forward it to the sustainability person and consider their job done. Those sorts of things. If I can just say those out loud and make them laugh, then next time maybe they'll do something better. Mm-hmm. I use this example all the time. There's a brilliant American comic called Hannibal Buress who has a joke about if you get out of a cab and you're angry with the cab driver, if you feel ripped off or overcharged, don't slam the door because they want the door closed. Leave the door open. And then the driver has to run out and get it. And you can run around and open his door and you can run around the whole time. You know, it's a daft little joke. I think of that joke every single time I get out of a cab.
Yeah.
And my job is, my self-appointed mission is to write a joke about recycling, the oceans, the global average temperature, whatever it is, to write jokes that are that sticky and that memorable, such that every time someone's about to do something, they remember the joke and it reminds them to do something slightly differently.
That would be amazing. That's really good.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Very good. I'm conscious of time, but I'm interested, what's the toughest room you've actually had to deliver to? Is it like a sort of stand-up room, or is it a, you know, a room full of business people and, you know, or sustainability leaders?
I will say, well, I did do a gig this year where I was told quite late in the day that I was going to be simultaneously translated into earpieces of several different nationalities. And then so I took some advice from a friend of mine who's done those gigs before, and they said, write down every word of your script, which I never normally do. I'll have bullet points on an app. Mm. He said, write it all down, save it in multiple file formats on a USB and online, and turn up the day before and give it to the translators. And my God, Nick Page, you saved my life, because I did that. It turned out that 30% of the room were Japanese. So that was a rush to be like to be very specifically stuck to a script, thinking they're translating this off the back of, you know, this. There was a lot to think about. So that, I mean, that's, I don't know if that answers your question. That's a novelty. That doesn't usually happen. I will say, I won't call it a tough room, but when I did Live at the Apollo, Klang, that's like 4,000 people in a room who certainly aren't expecting any climate stuff. And because it was being televised, because it was being shot and you only get one go, I felt like I was following my own musical notation. I'm normally quite a sort of free fall kind of, I'm very comfortable making it up as I go along around some bullet points. But this, I felt like I was dancing on, you know, when they have footsteps on the stage, like painted, not on the stage, you know what I mean? Like a dance class. I felt like I was doing that because I wanted to make sure I said what I wanted and implied what I wanted and didn't imply what I didn't want to. So that was very hard. That was very in the head there. In terms of businesses and the kind of corporate work, I mean, you know, I don't love cabaret style seating. That's not easy. But broadly speaking, I'm passionate, I'm articulate, and I've got some banging jokes. So I'm
Definitely.
yet to have one where I've really come away thinking, that's tough. You know, it'll never be as tough as the anaerobic and biogas, anaerobic digestion and biogas awards at the Birmingham NEC. Something like 12 years ago. That was
Right.
I that I now I'd love to go and but I've got loads on that now. But at the time I was like, I've got nothing for you people. I'm gonna do jokes about my kid. And they were like,
Yeah. Well, next time we speak, let's have a deep dive on that one. I feel like you speak to like multiple different parts of like the audience that I would have. Some might love comedy, some might be, climate dread, some might be business leaders or chief sustainability, leaders and that sort of thing. Is there one message that you can get, one single message that can that you'd like to leave for all the
For everyone, for
diverse
everyone.
audience?
Just don't be afraid to grapple with it. Don't be afraid to think about it. That's the entry level message. If you're further down the line, I've got more gear for you, but come and speak to me personally. I think the general blanket message is don't bury your head in the sand. Grappling with it is allowed. And the other big blanket message is we're all hypocrites. We're all complicit. We're all bound up in the carbon economy. If you let that shut you down and keep you silent, then the fossil fuel companies win. They would love it. The fossil fuel companies would love it if we all felt bad about our fossil fuel use and kept our mouths shut. So let's not do that.
That's good. I think it was you that did Climate Confessions, wasn't it? That's really good.
Yes, I do. This is a live thing that I do. I solicit climate confessions from my audience to try and undermine exactly that point, you know, the idea that you're not allowed an opinion unless you're perfect. So that's a lovely bit of business. So I'll do it in a, I think any room up to about 300, I can do that in, and that I get some lovely responses from there.
Very good. My most important question that I've got is the last one, which is where can people see? I know you're mainly doing rooms in the business world now and so on, but where can people see
Yes.
your maybe stand up?
Yes, so, well,
Obviously,
I'm going to be on
the
tour
podcast.
next year. I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival in August. Basically, if you're a business person, you can find me on LinkedIn. Ugh, that doesn't feel good to say.
LinkedIn.
And if you're not a business person, you can find me on Instagram or TikTok or all those other places, or at my website, which is stuartgoldsmith.com.
Yeah, fabulous. Well, I follow you on LinkedIn and I follow you on Instagram, but I only just recently installed TikTok, so
I do not have TikTok installed. I have no interest in that. It's too addictive. It's awful. It's bad to be in my life. But if you listening to this are a person who enjoys TikTok,
on
then
there.
you can enjoy my social media guy, Callum, uploading my stuff to TikTok.
Excellent. To be clear, I don't do dancing on there or anything. I did it because the girls that I coach football for started to get a bit bored by the drills, so I thought I'd get shorter drills off TikTok,
Love
which is
it.
working. So now,
Great.
5 second drills and that kind of
I
works.
think that's the only positive reason to get on
It's super, Stuart. It's really or SG SDG commitment. We'll stick with Stuart.
SDG.
I've loved having you on here. We've had a couple of conversations before. Really, really interesting to meet you, and I've really appreciated the conversation. Looking forward to the episode.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Gary.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Moved. If it sparks something for you, subscribe and share it with someone who's looking to make a difference. I'm Gary Watts, and I'll see you next time as we explore what moves people and ideas forward.